Hi, everyone. My name is Jose Sanchez.
And I'm Jen Toslim.
Welcome to episode 97 of the Criminology Academy podcast, where we are criminally academic. In this episode, we are speaking with Professor Justin Pickett.
Special topics highlighted in this episode include criminological research and public opinion, and policing and diversity.
Justin Pickett is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Albany SUNY. He received his PhD in criminology from Florida State University in 2011 and received the American Society of Criminology's Cavan Young Scholar Award in 2015. His research interests include public opinion, survey research methods, theories of punishment, and police-community relations.
For this episode, our conversation centers around two journal articles. The first is Public Opinion in Criminal Justice Policy, Theory and Research, which was published in the Annual Review of Criminology in 2019. And the second article is Officer Diversity May Reduce Black Americans' Fear of the Police, co-authored with Amanda Graham, Justin Nix, and Frank Cullen. It was published in Criminology in 2023. With that being said, let's bring Justin in.
Thank you for joining us today, Justin. We're very excited to have this conversation with you and talk about your work.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So the first topic I want to discuss with you is public opinion. And there is a lot to unpack when it comes to public opinion. And so you wrote a piece titled Public Opinion and Criminal Justice Policy, Theory and Research in the Annual Review of Criminology. In this article, you take stock of what we know regarding public opinion and offer your thoughts on, you know, future directions and areas we're still falling a little short. So let's start what I think is a basic but really broad question and basically ask you to define public opinion. Like, what is it that we're talking about when we say public opinion?
That's a really complex question that people have been debating and changed answers to for years. Answers started off with the idea that public opinion was some kind of abstract force in society. And then in the mid-1900s, with work by people like Bloomer, the idea was that it was mobilized opinion, the opinion of interest groups and people who are actively trying to take change. And then that transitioned in the latter part of the 1990s to aggregate opinion with work by people like Page and Shapiro. And then it changed to informed opinion, the idea that there's a difference between voice, what people say they want, and interest, what they would really want if they actually had all the information out there. And then it changed again to dynamic opinion, which is kind of the current understanding of it in political science, dynamic aggregate opinion. Essentially, in studies that people do across fields on public opinion, it is policy attitudes among civilians, normally considered to be adult civilians.
And that in and of itself seems very simple, but I'm sure measuring it has its own complications.
Absolutely, it does. Like, and, you know, because a lot of the surveys historically, the goal was to try to map elections, or in the mid and early 1900s, Gallup and people like that systematically excluded or underrepresented minorities and women because they didn't consider them part of the voting public, for example. Yeah, it is really interesting.
Yeah,
that is interesting.
So I think this kind of naturally leads us into this question of why does public opinion matter? Because, you know, we've spoken on the podcast before with other people how most people in the United States have limited and often pretty incorrect, based off of media and so on, understanding of crime and criminal justice and the system at large. Therefore, Jose and I were talking and we were like, in a perfect world, policymakers should be using research to make evidence-based decisions and implementations, right? Rather than decisions driven by the opinions of the public. And so I guess we're just kind of curious, why does this line of research matter? Why does public opinion matter?
That's a great question. And I mean, especially for scientists, we really want policy to be evidence-based. And it's complicated because there's a couple of pieces here. One, for science to be evidence-based, evidence has to be credible. And most of the research out there right now suggests that most science is not credible, right? It lacks a really strong causal identification strategy. There's extensive publication bias. Virtually every meta-analysis out there finds publication bias where scholars just write up what's significant. So if you made policy based on published evidence, probably be wrong as often as you're right. Once you get beyond that, the idea that the credibility of the evidence is, you know, highly questionable, unfortunately, I mean, we're moving in the right way, but it is. Then you get to the question of, well, even if you had great evidence, should the public matter? And that's kind of a philosophical debate. But in democracies, kind of the idea is that the public should have input on policy. Most people who study it in political science have made a distinction essentially between the public having input on goals. That is, what should policymakers prioritize? More than the means, how should they actually go about doing it, right? What are the social problems that should be addressed or prioritized? And then evidence ideally would kind of dictate exactly what to do. The other thing is that when you have evidence-based policy, sometimes policymakers and politicians who are elected are a little bit scared to follow it because they're afraid of electoral sanctions. And so public opinion, to the extent that it's studied and measured, can demonstrate that there's ideological space there for policymakers to follow the evidence instead of just following what they think are the wishes of the electorate.
Yeah, it just sort of reminds me, too, of like how we have a bit of evidence, a lot of studies that say, things like mass incarceration are bad. Tough on crime is not, like, it doesn't work. The war on drugs was a big failure. But because politicians think or feel or are encouraged to believe that that's what the public wants to hear, that they're going to keep them safe. And so that's kind of how they tend to lean sometimes, where they'll deliver their speeches saying that they're going to be tough on crime, that's going to keep the population safe. And so because there is that incentive of, well, I want these people to vote for me, right? So it's just, and I've read a few papers where scholars are like, well, scientists and politicians, we move at different speeds and in different timelines, right? Like, they're worried about re-election. We're worried about doing work that might take a few years to finish. So it's just this sort of triangle that very recently started to kind of start digging into that's really interesting. And so imagine kind of my surprise when as I'm digging into this, I realized that criminology, as you point out in this article, seems to not have the body of literature that perhaps one might think when it comes to public opinion, given that that this field is supposed to dedicate itself to studying crime and delinquency and the causes of crime. And so you say that one of the downfalls is that we have ignored research done in other fields like political science. And so what has the research in political science on public opinion revealed, and why might this be important for criminologists and in criminology? In general.
So political science is awesome. and I have just really, 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 I would say dorked out, really enjoyed reading political science and learning about it. In political science, public opinion has been, one of the main things they've studied for decades. And so their sophistication theoretically and methodologically on it way beyond what really has existed in criminology. So some of the things that they've done, just some of the things they've done in political science that have yet to really make it into criminology, and that explains some of the reasons criminologists have made mistakes and interpret public opinion, are differentiate between the ways public opinion might influence policy. Congruence, where policy matches what the public wants. So if 80% of the public wants something, that's a majority, it's a supermajority, the policy would exist. And responsiveness, where the policy may not match what the public wants, but it moves in the direction of public preferences. So as the public attitudes trend in a direction, policy trends in that direction, even if it never actually meets. Another thing that political science have done, which is just fascinating, but very straightforward when you think of it, is make this distinction between public mood and responses in individual surveys. So when you look at an individual survey, you can ask a whole bunch of different questions on something like the death penalty or get tough policies. And the percent of Americans that support it will be all over the place, right? Some, there'll be 80% support for one and 40% for the other. But what political science realized, scientists realized, is that all of those, almost like in a regular normal survey with a factor analysis, all those different items, they do have a shared underlying latent construct that's affecting variance in all of them. So there's shared variance across all of them, and then there's item-specific variance. So if you look at the trends in them over time, they all move together for the most part. For example, confidence in the president and in Congress and in state Supreme Courts and in governors, the trend lines for that are basically all the same. Now, they all have different intercepts. Some have higher confidence than others, but they all basically move together. Now, this idea of mood, a latent, underlined attitude about something, some of the political sciences recognized decades ago, and it's just awesome. And it really hasn't made it all the way into criminology yet. They also just in political science have been doing decades of research on whether or not public opinion actually does affect policy. And from the state Supreme Court to the actual U.S. Supreme Court, all the way to House of Representative members, does it influence policy in different areas? And if so, how?
So interesting that you're saying like political scientists have been doing this for decades. Like, why do you think it hasn't come into criminology? Has there just not really been an interest in researching public opinion? Or is it that we're not well read outside of the discipline? Or like, do you have any ideas of why this may be somewhat foreign to criminology?
I think, you know, early in my career, I had to kind of navigate the idea among some criminologists that public opinion was not real criminology, that criminology was a discipline that studied why people commit crime. And I know for a while, it didn't necessarily include policing and criminal justice stuff. It made a distinction. I think it has been hard to convince some criminologists that public opinion is actually a real part of criminology. And so they, for example, how many doctoral programs in criminology in the country, Maryland, Penn State, have a class on public opinion? I think the University of Florida does, and I know we do, but I don't think many do. They don't teach it, right? And so that created a situation where criminologists and people trained in, you know, criminology and criminal justice went into studying public opinion without the tools. And when they really started studying, it was in the last half of the 1900s, right, of the 20th century. When mass incarceration happened, criminologists became interested in public opinion because polls were coming out showing that members of the public were really punitive, right? That 80% or 90% supported things like the death penalty and three strike laws. And so they saw these snapshots and it was inconsistent with their disciplinary ideology, right? Most criminologists are against punitive policies. They're against mass incarceration. And so as Frank Cullen has pointed out, they were motivated to try to discredit these single poll results. And they did it in a multi-pronged attack. One of the attacks was to say, listen, people are inconsistent. If you give them similar questions on the same thing that are a little bit different, do you support the death penalty or would you rather have the death penalty or life in prison without parole? The levels of support are totally different. It drops from majority to barely supportive. If you give them information that should make them less punitive, they become way less punitive. Of course, if you give them information that should make them more punitive, they'll become more punitive. If you look at the same people and they answer the same question at two different time periods, they give different answers. Like 40% of them will give different answers. So they tried to invalidate these polls. And what they missed, which is right in front of them, is that these different questions move together at the same time. They might have different levels, but they move together at the same time and inform public opinion. Like when you look at people who have a lot of knowledge, they are less punitive, but they move in the same way as people who are less knowledgeable. The trend lines for informed people and uninformed people are the same. They're just at different slopes. And if you give people information in the context of an experiment, it has an effect, but it's this methodological artifact. It goes away. Every study that's followed people has shown that from tests of the Marshall hypothesis on down, that any information effect is temporary. It goes away in a couple of weeks to a couple of months. So they just missed all that because their main thing was to say this level of public support that suggests the public wants mass incarceration is wrong.
So interesting. So I know in your review article, you talk about other elements too, other reasons for these misperceptions about public opinion that have become so entrenched in criminology and really slowed the development of good research and understanding. So can you just talk about briefly some of these other reasons for misperceptions?
Sure. A lot of them kind of tie to what I said, the misunderstanding, the difference between what they call global attitudes. Do you support a policy versus do you want to apply it? So like one famous study found that like almost everybody supports three strike laws, but when you actually ask them to sentence people, like 16 or 17% will actually apply them, even when they're giving people who would get three strikes under the law. And so you got 17% who would actually use three strike laws compared to like 88% who support it. And they just interpreted that wrong, right? As this being public opinion is mushy or ill-formed or inconsistent, instead of understanding that these are two different types of questions. The biggest thing is that criminologists really didn't study trends. When they did try to study trends, they often did look at one year and look at another. There's a really famous book that says that public opinion didn't change at all over the course of like two decades. And what it did is it picked one year at the beginning and one year at the end where the level of public opinion, according to Gallup, was the same. And it entirely neglected the fact that during those 2 years, those 2 points, end point and beginning point, public opinion changed by over 14 points. It went up 14 points and went down 14 percentage points, right? That's a huge change. They just didn't actually study change. They just missed it completely.
So given what we've discussed thus far, acknowledging that research on public opinion and criminology is fairly limited and variation in opinions exist over time and space, is from what we know now, is the public more likely to support punitive or rehabilitative practices in the United States?
They're more likely to support both. The interesting thing and the accurate answer is that the public supports both punitive and rehabilitative policies. The tendency to support punitive policies is inversely related to support for rehabilitative policies, which means that as punitiveness goes up, support for rehabilitation goes down. It's not a really strong inverse relationship, but they are related. They support both, but over time they both change. So to put it differently, as the Get Tough movement was getting going, right, in the last half of the 20th century, public support for punitive policies went up dramatically. It escalated dramatically. When you take all the different indicators, support for the death penalty, views about court harshness, when you take all of them and you put them together in a generalized mood measure, it skyrocketed in the last half of the 20th century, peaking out in the mid-1990s. Depending on which particular mood measure you use, public punitiveness escalated from basically the 70s to around 1993, 1994. And then beginning in the mid-1990s, it began to drop. And unbeknownst to many people, public punitiveness has dropped every year almost since, right? Since 1994, public punitiveness has just gone dramatically down. Support for the death penalty is down to close to an all-time low, right? In modern America, court harshness perceptions are down. If you look at the trend since the mid-1990s, they're down, and support for rehabilitation is up. So they, what I'm saying is they support both, but the tendency to support one over the other changes over time. And right now, the change, the three-decade change that's ongoing, is away from punitive policies and towards rehabilitation policies.
And do we know, or do we have anything that tells us if policymakers are responsive to public opinion? Like, because, you know, saying that, like a politician saying that they listen to the public and that they want to have the public's best interest and actually doing it are two different things. So do we know if they're responsive to public opinion?
We do. There's tremendous research, tons of studies done both in the United States and in other democracies that have shown that they are. And most of what the studies have done have been to measure generalized punitiveness and look to see how changes over time in punitive mood are related to things like state incarceration rates, federal incarceration rates, the probability of state Supreme Court judges finding reversible error in death penalty cases. When you get a sentence to death, it automatically is appealed up, and state Supreme Court justice can overturn it on reversible error. There have been numerous studies. Almost all of them have been done in political science. They've been done by people like Peter Enns, Scott Duxbury, who's a sociologist at North Carolina, and they all of them, every one of them finds the same thing. And that is that changes over time in public punitiveness, as the public becomes more punitive, policymakers respond and policy gets more punitive. States adopt more harsh sentencing laws. Federal incarceration rates go up. Federal expenditures on the criminal justice system go up. State Supreme Court justices become less likely to find reversible error in actual cases. Ballmer has a study showing that local level punitiveness affects the way people are actually prosecuted and found guilty and convicted in cases in local areas, right? Like counties. It all shows the same thing. The only caveat is this, and this is something that a lot of people misunderstand. Going back to the idea of responsiveness and congruence, policymakers are not congruent with the public. That is, when the majority of the public supports some policy, that doesn't mean they're going to get it. Rather, what policymakers are is responsive to trends. When the public is trending in a direction, like towards punitiveness or away from punitiveness, most of the action in that issue is towards the direction of that trend. The reason they aren't responsive in terms of congruence, they are responsive, but the reason they aren't congruent is because they over-respond to trends. In other words, policymakers tend to implement policies in a consistent set. So when they're getting more punitive, they adopt punitive policies. They don't mix and match and take a punitive policy and a rehabilitative policy. When they begin to get less punitive, when the public turns away from it, most of the policy action is towards rehabilitative, preventative, non-punitive policies. That's generally what studies have shown. The congruence rate is like half of the time. Do you see actual matching between public majority preference and policy? But the evidence of what they call dynamic responsiveness is overwhelming. But that is how policymakers run. And it explains the gun control issue. You can find a gun control policy where 95% of the public supports it. But most of the trends in gun control preferences since the 1960s have been down towards less support for gun control. Like if you look at the trend lines for support for a handgun ban, they've been down over decades, right? And so the trends in overall public support for gun control is down, even though you got really high support for some specific policy.
Yeah, that's so, I guess I hadn't thought about that. And we just talked to someone who does work on gun control. And so it's interesting to take what we learned from that episode and apply it to what you just said, that this trend is decreasing, even though people are still supporting, you know, certain gun control policies, but the trend downward, interesting to think about.
It makes it a complicated policy environment because you got a trend that's in the opposite direction of majority preference on specific policies, and it just makes it more difficult for policymakers to feel comfortable moving in one direction or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see how certain members of the public could be like, you're doing the opposite of what we want based off of, you know, calls for certain policies, even though it's the trend that they're following. It's interesting to think about. So clearly there's a lot of work being done on this in political science and has been, not as much in criminology and criminal justice. So what are some of your suggestions or, you know, potential implications for criminal justice research and then also like policy and practice regarding public opinion?
There's a lot of them. I mean, I would just baseline hope that criminologists would spend more time studying the relationship between public opinion and incarceration policy and policing policy, right? Economists have looked to see, for example, if public opinion influences police activities, but there's not been a lot of really good criminological research on it. So I'd like to see more of it. It is really important to study public opinion for a number of reasons. For example, when formulating things like sentencing statutes, it was widely recognized that the ideal is they wouldn't be too off public opinion, which is why in a famous study, Rossi and Burke, you know, with federal government support, did a huge study to try to map public preferences to the sentencing guidelines to see if they lined up, because they wanted to make sure that the way people are punished in court, that the factors that go into judicial sentences are the same that the public would use. And they found that they basically are. They're very, very similar. And that's important. The implication of that is important because if they're not, it's going to undercut the legitimacy of the law. There's a concept called flouting the law. In several experimental papers, they've shown that when people lose legitimacy because they think punishments are too harsh or too lenient, they actually, the legitimacy of the law goes down and their own willingness to follow it declines. But it's just important to study public opinion when formulating criminal justice policy for legitimacy at a bare minimum.
Okay, so now we want to switch gears a little bit and discuss another area of your research. And this focuses more on policing and fear of the police and police brutality. And so we want to talk about one of your other papers that you wrote around the topic of diversity within law enforcement and fear. And so the paper is titled, Officer Diversity May Reduce Black Americans' Fear of the Police. It was co-authored with Amanda Graham, Justin Nix, and Frank Cullen. It was published in Criminology in 2023. And so to get this discussion started, we want to talk about these two leading theoretical models that you discuss in the paper that explain the high prevalence of police-related fear among Black Americans, the victimization and vulnerability models. So can you tell us more about these two?
Sure, absolutely. The victimization and vulnerability models are models that were originally developed to explain fear of crime, and they apply to any type of fear, essentially. The victimization model essentially says that people, it's an experiential model. People who have more relevant experience, and in this case, you're talking about victimization, should be more afraid. So in the case of policing, it's personal experience or vicarious experience with mistreatment from officers. That is in the past. That is, do you know people or have you specifically been verbally abused, physically abused, wrongfully stopped by police officers in the past? The theory is that people who have more experience with mistreatment should be more afraid. This is relevant to the racial gap because every study that's ever looked at it, from the government studies, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, all the way down to academic studies across decades, have found that Black Americans are the racial group that reports the most negative experience, mistreatment with police. They are the most likely to say they've been verbally abused, they've been wrongfully stopped, that they've been physically abused, and that they know people who have. So because they have higher rates of experiences, victimization experiences, they should be more afraid. That's the victimization model. The vulnerability model is somewhat similar. In the fear of crime world, it's used to explain why women, people who are handicapped, older people, and minorities may be more afraid of crime. The argument is that groups in society who feel that they are exposed to danger, that they are unable to protect themselves, and that the consequences, should they fall victim, are really severe, should be more afraid. In the case of policing, what this is really saying is that if African Americans believe that police have racial prejudice, that officers use racial stereotypes, and if they have a cultural understanding of the racist nature historically of police functioning, right, then they should feel more vulnerable. They should feel like the probability of being stopped may not have anything to do with what they do. It may have everything to do with stereotypes. And that if they are stopped because of prejudice or racism, they may not have control over what happens, and it may become really serious. Right. As one person said, if you're sharing racist tweets talking about officers, then you're racist. And if you're racist, you may kill me. Right. So the idea is that stereotypes and prejudice should make African-Americans, along with a cultural understanding of the history of race and policing, feel more vulnerable to police mistreatment and thus be more afraid.
So among a laundry list of items, one particular point that seems to get brought up a lot by critics of the police is that the vast majority of police officers are white dudes, white guys. And this can have implications based on the theoretical models that you just discussed, because Black Americans may have experiences with mistreatment and their perceptions of racism in policing. Therefore, one strategy could be to increase diversity among police forces. So, without getting into your results, theoretically, why might a more racially diverse police force, one that more closely resembles the communities they serve, reduce fear of the police?
So in political science and in other fields, they have a theory of representative bureaucracy that argues that essentially people should be happier with social institutions that are more representative of them, because it'd be their active representation or symbolic representation. Active representation would be where, when, for example, Black Americans become officers, they're able to actually change police culture and activities and the amount of accountability in policing and improve policing objectively. The symbolic model is more straightforward, and that is, even if there are no actual changes in policing, people may believe institutions are better, fairer, less scary, if those institutions better represent their groups or groups in society. The argument here essentially is, if Black Americans believe that Black officers and Hispanic officers are less likely to hold racial stereotypes, to be racially prejudiced, right, then they should be less afraid, right? If their concern is being mistreated in part because of the racist nature of policing, if they believe that there are racial differences in how officers behave, even if they're not, even if their perceptions are wrong, if they believe and perceive that Black and Hispanic officers are less likely to use racial stereotypes, less likely to harbor racial prejudice, and more concerned with and supportive of the rights and privileges and interests of historically marginalized groups, then as diversity in policing increases, Black Americans should become less afraid. Theoretically, that's what the theory suggests.
And so one other thing that you do in this paper is not just like racial diversification within law enforcement. You also talk about and bridge gender diversity into your discussion by arguing that police gender diversification may reduce fear via representation and perceptions of sex differences in decision making and behavior. Can you walk us through a little bit more about the theoretical arguments here, like you just did for racial diversification?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. And the theory of representative bureaucracy also applies to gendered representation in social institutions. The basic argument in the case of gender is this. There is a tremendous amount of evidence that women are better at emotion work and have higher empathy on average than men. And the theory is that people, white and black, may believe that when more women are represented in policing, that they will be better able to de-escalate situations, to empathize with people in stops. They will be more caring. They will have better social skills, that they will increase accountability in police agencies, and that they will offset the male-dominated masculine culture that often working class, male-dominated working class culture that often characterizes police agencies. There's also strong evidence, as anybody who studies criminology knows, that there are real, consistent, near universal differences in actual aggressive and violent behavior between men and women. Men are always and everywhere more likely to engage in violence. There's also public opinion research over three decades that have shown that one place that the public does not have misperceptions is this. The public accurately understands, they're accurately able to estimate gender differences in violent behavior. So if Americans, white, black, or not, believe that women and female officers will be more empathetic, have better social skills, and be less aggressive, then as the number of women in policing increases, they may become less afraid, which is really notable because women are about half of the U.S. population and about 12% of the U.S. police force.
That like bridges perfectly into my next question for you, which is, you know, given these theoretical arguments that we're talking about, increasing racial and gender diversity, what kind of efforts, if any, have undertaken by police departments to improve diversity? Like, what do the numbers look like?
The numbers are, they have improved but stabilized, to my understanding. The unfortunate thing is that the early efforts at diversification were often stimulated by lawsuits. People sued because they felt like they were being discriminated against in terms of hiring and promotion in police agencies, and that did stimulate diversity efforts. There have been self-directed efforts of many different types in many different agencies across the country. One of the most notable ones is called the 30 by 30 initiative, where it's a nationwide effort where police agencies are signing on to try to increase the representation of women in their police agencies to at least 30% by 2030 from what is, again, about 12% nationwide. That's an example of broader, not localized, but kind of national effort, which is really great. The problem is that efforts at hiring and promotion fail when the environment within police departments for minorities and women is really hostile and unfavorable. And what hasn't happened and needs to happen, or what hasn't happened at the level it should, is efforts to stop racial and sexual harassment among officers. And there are tons of stories and lawsuits coming out from women and from minority officers where they talk about being subjected to racist language and sexual harassment and inappropriate touching. And if you want to have minorities and women in policing, you have to make it a welcoming environment for officers of color and for women.
Yeah. Similar stories are coming out, I think, all over the place, whether it's the military or correctional departments or what. And so I think a lot of people are trying to really tackle this issue of how do we change the work culture, which I'll be interested to see what people come up with. But
okay, so for the study that we're discussing, we used a sample of 511 Black Americans and 589 non-Black Americans. And you had two experimental designs that you implemented for the study to gauge fear of the police. Can you tell us more about the two experiments that you constructed for the study?
Sure. The first experiment, and we tried, my team of co-authors and I, to make sure that the experiments were different, so that, you know, we could be sure if the findings were similar across the experiments, that they weren't limited to one design. The first experiment was a conjoint analysis where people got paired profiles of officers, essentially a table with two columns that described two hypothetical officers who randomly varied on a whole host of characteristics, whether or not they had a body-worn camera, whether or not they had past civilian complaints, their race, ethnicity, and their gender. And respondents indicated which of the officers would make them most afraid. collectively, the respondents were presented with 11,000 randomly generated officer profiles. So 11,000 randomly generated officer profiles, and they indicated which in each pairing made them most afraid. In the second experiment, we used a picture-based factorial vignette. What we wanted to do is the first one just described race and gender in words. It said Black or Hispanic or female. And we weren't sure, because in reality, that's not how people encounter race and not how they encounter gender, that that would necessarily hold. So what we did is we went in the second one and we got pictures. The Chicago Face database has all hundreds of pictures of models that have come in. They come in, they agree to have their pictures used, they get pictures taken, and then they have a group of people, anywhere from 30 to 90, rate these models in their pictures on whether or not they look angry and trustworthy and happy, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can get pictures that differ by race and differ by gender, but have the same average perceived level or this similar level of trustworthiness or anger. So we went in and we got some pictures that were matched as closely as possible on factors like this, trustworthiness. And then I had my young son put them in officer uniforms from a real department. And we randomly assigned people to get that and a vignette describing a stop and asked them how afraid they would be in the stop. And that way we could compare the effect of race and of gender in the pictures in the vignette as well, where you're describing a particular stop, to the preference in the conjoint analysis between the profiles of officers that were randomly generated.
So fascinating. It just makes me think of all of the studies that are being done on skin color within like the race and ethnicity literature and just how important those perceptions are. So I think it's a really cool way that you designed the experiment.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so it's time. Let's get into the results of your study. So you had, based off of these experiments, you had two main hypotheses. The first one was that Black Americans will be less afraid when officers are non-white, that is Black or Hispanic, instead of being white. What were your key findings for this hypothesis?
So we found that among Black Americans, the officer diversity in terms of race mattered, that Black Americans reported that in both experiments that they would be less afraid of a Black officer or of a Hispanic officer than they would be of a white officer, both in the picture experiment and in the conjoint analysis. By contrast, among non-Black Americans, the effects of officer race were smaller and inconsistent. It didn't really seem to matter much. So diversity seemed to really matter for the Black respondents in our sample, but it wasn't clear that it would matter or have any real effects among non-Black respondents.
Okay, and then your second hypothesis was that Black Americans will be less afraid when officers are female instead of male, getting into the gender diversity argument. Did your findings support this hypothesis?
They did. So Black Americans reported being significantly less afraid of female officers than of male officers in both experiments. But what's notable here as well is non-Black respondents did too, right? And they reported they would be less afraid of female officers. So it seems that gender diversification may more broadly reduce fear among both Black and non-Black Americans.
So interesting, the difference for white respondents. Yeah.
Okay, so what then would you say are the implications that result from your findings on diversity and fear for the police, not only for research, but also policy and practice?
So I think starting point is we do need more research. We need more research that examines diversity using different designs, experimental designs, to see if it is in fact something that holds. And if so, are the beneficial effects of diversity conditional on, for example, reaching a critical mass? One study has found that it takes a critical mass of Black officers to really begin to have effects. Are they conditional on social context, where it happens? For example, in the South versus in the North, right? Or in areas that are, you know, heavily diverse in the surroundings versus not. I mean, I think we need a lot more research on it. But the baseline point, the evidence that exists, the best evidence. So you basically have a large body of research on diversity and a large body of research on gender diversity. The research on racial diversity is really mixed, very mixed. So mixed that you could probably say that at least half, if not more studies have found that it either will not have a beneficial effect, or if it does have an effect, it might actually be harmful, but it's really hard to study it well. And the very best studies, the one that came out in Science Magazine and another that's been done recently in economics, the better the methodology, the more likely it seems that the findings are in favor of diversity. So I would generally say that given our findings and the existing work right now, and given the normative belief that diversity is a good thing, police departments should really try to increase racial diversity. We also know that the public supports it, and so do police officers. There's a PNAS study that shows that. In the case of gender diversity, the existing evidence is pretty clear that whenever there's an effect of gender diversity, it's always beneficial for the most part. The evidence out there is either null or in favor of gender diversity, and our study is too. So I think that initiatives like the 30 times 30 initiative are really good ideas, and that there should be real efforts to diversify, to hire more female officers.
And also retain them.
And retain them by reducing exactly harassment and sexual assault, precisely.
Is retaining officers of color challenging to the same degree as it is for female officers?
I don't know about how you would quantify the same degree, but I know it is challenging. And I know, for example, I'm not trying to say that it's unbelievable in the sense that I was shocked. A number of lawsuits have been filed by officers of color about racial discrimination and harassment in the departments, right? I think it's over 100 officers, Capitol officers in the U.S. Capitol, over the last number of years have filed these suits. So, there's no doubt, right, that they're experiencing an awful amount of harassment and discrimination within ranks. And it's a problem.
So that keeping them there after you hire them, right, Definitely important. Okay, so Jose and I want to ask you about the kind of public response that this study has had. You posted the study on X when it came out, and you caught, I guess to put it mildly, some flack for it. In particular, you received criticisms that no Black scholars were included in the design of the experiment or write-up of the study. Experimental design does not always equate to the real world. And that you and your colleagues more or less advocated for simply increasing diversity in the police and not necessarily improving police-citizen interactions overall. And so how would you respond to these criticisms?
That's a really good question. I appreciate you asking it. I was surprised by the reaction, and I appreciate the feedback from people on Twitter. And I took a lot of time to really think about it. And I kind of broke out the comments that were made into the main categories that are there and organized my thoughts around them. So let me go through each of those categories and kind of explain my thinking on what they are. So one of the main categories was that the only correct reform is to abolish the police because it's a racist institution. And several of the commenters specifically said this, that you should abolish them. And thus studying any other reform is problematic. This is an interesting take. I mean, it's a position where someone has an opinion already and, evidence on other options is maybe not of interest. I would say there are some real problems here. So the most important problem with this critique that studies like mine or ours and studies in general of policing reforms are problematic because the only correct answer is to abolish or defund the police really run into a problem that they ignore the voice of Black Americans. So tons of surveys by Gallup, by Pew, have shown that only a small minority of Black Americans, somewhere around 21 to 28%, want to abolish the police. Studies that have asked about whether or not you want to maintain or increase patrols in your local area and police spending in your local area have found that somewhere around 76 to 80% of Black Americans say they either want to maintain the number of police patrols or increase it. They want to maintain spending on local policing or increase it. So to argue that you shouldn't study other reforms besides abolishing the police is to ignore those voices of Black Americans, which I think is problematic. Additionally, there is a tremendous amount of evidence that policing does reduce crime, that it has crime prevention effects, that it's actually one of the most cost-effective ways to bring crime down. The second thing that came up on Twitter, which you mentioned a little bit, and the thing is that we're studying diversification, but we're not studying all these other reforms that may be better, have more effects, or be more easy to implement, such as, civilian review boards, transparency initiative, having registries of officers who have complaints filed against them. I think that's an interesting comment, too. What I would note is that when you study a particular reform, you're not implying that other reforms are not important. In the actual paper, we review the evidence of many of these other reforms, many experiments that have tested things like knock and talks, right? Procedural justice. And the idea is that we want to identify as many good reforms as we can. We also, in our study, test body-worn cameras? Or would that make people less afraid, which is one of the key accountability-based reforms that's out there? So I hope, and we never argue in our paper, that people don't think that in studying diversity, we're suggesting that no other reform is worthwhile. The third critique came in is on the design. A couple of commenters really heavily critiqued the design, even calling it stupid. And the argument there on the research design is that what people say in a survey is entirely different from an interaction with a police officer on the street. That fear of the police is going to be different in an encounter with an officer than in a survey. A couple of points to note about that, right? One, Black Americans are not just afraid of police in encounters. Fear of police pervades their daily life so much. I've had emails from many people, but from people who, after they read the paper, not this paper, but the previous American Racial Divide paper, email me, are so scared of police in their daily life that they won't call them when they need help, when someone in their household is having a mental health breakdown, because they're afraid that person will end up getting hurt or killed, right? But it's not just in encounters that African Americans are afraid. Second, in actual encounters, over 96% of them don't escalate. They don't involve yelling. They don't involve cursing. They don't involve threats. They don't involve any use of force. So although I'm sure they're more intense than a survey, they're not an escalated account that people might have in their minds. The third thing to note about this is there's a tremendous amount of research on effective forecasting. How accurate are people in anticipating their emotions? They are very, very good at it. They're not good at anticipating how long they will feel those emotions, but they're very good at anticipating how they will feel. If you ask someone who's scared to go on planes how they would feel on a plane, they can tell you. If you ask someone how they would feel if they went home and found their spouse cheating on them, they can tell you. People are very good at it. Probably the biggest issue, though, is that there actually is, and we review it in the paper, a good bit of experimental evidence looking at whether or not survey findings mirror the same findings from field experiments on policing. So they've done survey experiments on policing, numerous ones on procedural justice and other such things, and then done field experiments on them. And the findings from the survey experiments and the field experiments align perfectly. For example, we know that procedural justice in an encounter in a survey and in a stop, a traffic stop, whether in Turkey or in Australia, has huge effects on your perceptions of the encounter, but trivial effects on your overall views about police. They both show the same thing. So there is no evidence right now. It doesn't mean it won't be the case, but there is no evidence right now that the findings you get on policing in survey experiments don't actually generalize. All the evidence is in the opposite direction, right? So I think the design is pretty strong there. That brings us to the hardest critique, and I understand it. And that's the critique that a team of white authors should not be studying this issue. Should not be studying, as a couple of commenters put it, social problems in Black America, Black suffering. I thought a lot about it. And one thing to note is that I think most academics are. I know I'm strongly supportive of diversity in academia and diversity in society at large. I think it's critical. I think it's a mistake to say that an author's or scholar's race or the racial composition of a group should determine group of authors what research questions they address or will determine how well they address them or will determine their findings. I think it's a mistake for a couple of reasons. And let me be really clear on this. So one of the arguments is that a group of white authors studying Black Americans and policing would come into it and not know what questions to ask, would focus on the wrong thing. But the views of Black Americans, the values of Black Americans, the experience of Black Americans can inform research through a lot of ways. Here's one key way. Surveys of African Americans, probability surveys over the last three decades have shown that they overwhelmingly support diversification. They are like 30 percentage points more supportive of diversifying the police than are white Americans. All the way back in the book Race and Policing in 2006, one of the key findings was that Black Americans and Hispanic Americans were strongly supportive of diversification efforts for police. Their values, their attitudes, their voices can be represented in our work. We can see that, and we're testing a policy they support. Another example, and to not do it, to not study diversification, would be to ignore those voices of many, many, many African Americans interviewed over many, many, many years. Another key thing is this is science is cumulative, We stand on each other's shoulders. Although our study had four co-authors and we were all white, many amazing scholars are working in the realm of policing scholarship and race and policing scholarship and are studying diversification. For example, the Science article that came out, the lead author, Ba, is a person of color. They are studying diversification. The overall group of people studying this issue is very diverse. We took an issue that is a legitimate issue and we applied a research design and tried to study it the best we can. The other thing is, I would hope that a research design and an adequate research design would separate the characteristics of the authors from the evidence, right? That the evidence that comes out of a given study, if you have the right research design, will not depend on who the authors are or on their values, on what policies they support going into it. I mean, that said, I do know that, as Guldner put it, objectivity is the pathology of cognition. None of us can ever be objective. But given a research question that has already been roundly shown to be important by Black Americans in surveys and Black scholars studying it, using a given experimental design, you should be able to get the same evidence regardless of the characteristics of the authors going into it.
Yeah, I think that last point is super important. Basically, where I arrived, like, if the study is constructed well, like, it shouldn't matter if it's you that's running the study, if it's me that's running the study, or if it's Jen that's running the study, right? Like, as long as it's done well, like, the results don't know that the lead author is white, Hispanic, or Black, right? Like, the results are the results, and the science is the science. At least, you know, that's always the approach and the stance that I've taken to those critiques, because I don't know, I've never quite understood it.
That's absolutely true. Also, in the idea of, did we design the study and carry it out without input from Black scholars? I mean, my perspective on that is that in reading the work of Black scholars, in citing the work of Black scholars, in building on previous research conducted by Black scholars, we were not going into this without input from Black Americans. In looking at the poll results over many decades that show that Black Americans want to diversify police, we were going into this with input. We weren't going into it as just a group of people on our own doing what we thought was best. I hope that's right. All that said is, I think diversity and co-authorship is absolutely critical and important, and I'm all for it. I'm not trying to say it's not important.
Yeah, we just want to say, like, thank you so much for taking the time to address those critiques. We know you didn't really do much of the responding on X, so thank you for thinking through them and answering them on the podcast. Our last kind of question is, you know, in criminology, a lot of us do work that eventually there's going to be someone who is critiquing it, whether it's, you know, in the peer review process or more publicly on Twitter or X or, you know, something else. And so what are your recommendations for how individuals should handle these moments of criticism?
I think criticism is really important. It hurts. I mean, it really hurts your heart. I mean, when we spent all the time and effort doing this study, we did it because we want to improve relationships between Black Americans and police. We want to reduce suffering in Black communities. So we went into it with the idea of doing research that potentially is helpful to Black Americans. And it really hurts your heart when you get criticized. That said, criticism is important. And my general suggestion would be, when you get criticized, especially like on Twitter and stuff, is not to respond, at least not immediately. I didn't. I wanted to take time to think about things, to read and consider what people said. I also wanted people to feel comfortable that they could quote treat the article. I know some people said that we were unethical for doing this, that no journal should publish it, the design was stupid. I want people to feel comfortable, you know, tweeting it and comment on it, or even commenting on it without thinking that I'm going to get on there and I'm going to start attacking them personally or aggressively arguing with them, because it's not, I mean, science is about argument. And if someone writes a comment or critique in the article in a journal, then absolutely we would need to respond. But I think people should have a right to express their opinions about research. And as much as it hurt, the best thing to do is to listen, to go through and try to figure out whether or not you think, and in this case, the main criticisms that were there, I don't think are as big of problems with the study as people might think. But if I did, that would lay the ground for work for something else. The only other thing I would say is, if scholars, regardless of where you are, particularly young scholars, though, people always say rejection is the norm, but it really is. It's not only that, but it's like most of the big famous things you know about, like Dr. Seuss, right? And his books, the book Confederacy of Dunces, which won a Pulitzer Prize, had an unbelievable amount of rejection. So the Confederacy of Dunces were rejected everywhere, and the author killed himself. And his mom spent the next 10 years trying to get it published. And when she finally did, it won the Pulitzer. Dr. Seuss was rejected all over the place, right? J.K. Rowling's books were laughed about until they got published. The original Star Wars was run out. It had a different title, but all the major seminars refused to make it. And then it made it, and it became this huge thing. John Grisham, his first couple of books were, it's every example where you look at people. There's a book called The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Life. And it says that successful people are the set of people that don't quit. Because everybody runs into rejection. And it's really bad, right? A couple of my most highly cited papers. One of my most highly cited papers was rejected repeatedly. And another one was rejected at 6 journals before it landed. And now it's in the top 3 that the most highly cited I ever have. I know I'm rambling. There's a chapter in one of Cullen's books where he interviews the authors of Routine Activities Theory. That paper was rejected before it landed. And it's like hugely influential. Terry Moffitt's theory on the dual taxonomy, right? That was rejected at Criminology and ASR and other journals like that before it finally landed. And this is a huge thing, right? I would just, criticism's important. It's really good to not let it overtake you.
Easier said than done, yes. But that's good advice. Yes. I'm going to take that to heart.
Right. Yeah, me too. Sometimes I'll get a journal review and I would just like sit in a stupor, just mad at the world. But, eventually I try to get over it and move forward.
Even at this stage, having done it for like 12 years, when I get a journal review back before I read it, like a decision, my blood pressure shoots up and I'm scared and I often won't open it for a day or two to prepare myself for it because it's almost always a rejection and it ruins my day. So, and I got one, for example, when I was on a trip to an aquarium with my kids on, and it just ruined the whole trip for me, and it shouldn't. Don't be like me.
I did that too. But anyways, thank you so much for joining us today. Those are all the questions that we had for you. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything that you have in the works that we should be on the lookout for?
Not really. I'm just really excited to be here. I think that what y'all are doing with the podcast and all the people you've interviewed, from students to, I know you just posted the one right, it's just awesome. I mean, it's really cool. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And so if people have more questions, where can they find you? You're on X. Email is probably good too, I imagine.
So I am on X, which still in my head is Twitter. But the thing is, I don't actually get on there much. I respond to my emails rapidly, like within 10 minutes normally, but I can't be on X because it hurts my mental health. Essentially, I get on there and I can't stop scrolling because there are all these really cool articles. And then I start thinking about what's, and it just takes me away. So I jump on there and post something and jump off, but I always respond to emails. So if you need me for anything, if you have questions, email me and I will get back to you.
Great. And we will post that in the episode description. So thank you again. We really appreciated it. This was a fun conversation.
Thank you. Okay. Have a good day.
You too. Hey, thanks for listening.
Don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, or let us know what you think of the episode by leaving us a comment on our website, thecriminologyacademy.com.
You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Crim Academy. That's THECRIMACADEMY.
Or email us at thecrimacademy@gmail.com.
See you next time.